The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
I know that we've all been nagging our mail carriers and checking our mailboxes daily in hopes of the arrival of that much-touted, long-awaited economic stimulus package all tied up in a bow. That package that once received will serve to pull the American economy and its people back from the brink of recession, steering us boldly away from depression. In the meantime, as we await the arrival of said gift, we have for you this evening an Aloud program package sure to stimulate, at the very least, some thought regarding the bigger economic picture that is the global economy. This evening, Jeffrey Sachs, in conversation with Ira Jackson of Claremont Graduate University's Drucker Institute, will discuss his latest book, Commonwealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet, which itself represents a rather terrifyingly mixed package of environmental crisis, rising global population, and extreme poverty, an economic package designed to stimulate and energize the world into adopting more sustainable economic strategies that are global, inclusive, cooperative, and environmentally aware. Jeffrey D. Sachs received his BA, MA, and PhD from Harvard and is currently the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the Millennium Development Goals. He is internationally renowned for his work as an economic advisor to governments and international organizations around the world. Professor Sachs was named as one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in both 2004 and 2005. His acclaimed book, The End of Poverty, was a New York Times bestseller. In conversation with Professor Sachs this evening is Ira Jackson, Dean of the Claremont Graduate University's Peter F. Drucker and Masatoshi Ito Graduate School of Management. To borrow from yesterday's LA Times feature on Ira Jackson, he describes himself as a curious George. By age 26, he had advised the mayors of Newark, New Jersey, and Boston. At age 32, he was building a program at the Kennedy School to teach administrative skills to mayors of major cities. During 5 years at the head of Massachusetts Department of Revenue, Jackson helped engineer a period of economic growth that was later touted as the Massachusetts Miracle. From 1987 to 1999, as executive vice president of Bank Boston, he helped start an operation catering to inner-city residents as well as a separate branch to serve low-income investors. He is the co-author with Jay Nelson of Profits and with Principles, Strategies for Delivering Value with Values. This evening's conversation will be followed by a 10 to 15 minute Q&A. We'd like to remind you to make sure that it's a question you're asking rather than a statement you're making. We will be using a microphone for your questions, so please wait for it to get to you before asking that question. If it's worth asking, it's worth hearing. Our program this evening will conclude with a book signing in the Taper lobby. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in silencing your cell phones and in welcoming Jeffrey Sachs and Ira Jackson to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Professor Sachs is the good-looking one.
And an old put it to an audience vote.
And an old friend from Boston, so I'm delighted to be back with him and thrilled to have the privilege of moderating this conversation, which will engage you shortly. But for those of you who haven't read the book and who are just waiting for Professor Sachs to sign it, let me say that you have a treat ahead of you. It's an important book. It's dense with facts and analysis, but what Jeffrey does more than the other 99 other influential people on that Time magazine list, and especially the other economists, is that he has a point of view, and it's a values-oriented point of view. So he not only shares facts with us, but he lays out an alternative future which is based upon principles. And for that, and for so many other things in his life, I think we're all grateful for the leadership that he's brought, which is rare out of the Academy. So let's begin, Jeff, with the basic premise of the book. As Justin said, we all know global warming, abject poverty, global conflict, and rising terrorism. You identify all of those issues, but you lay out an alternative strategy for the world for the next 40 or 50 years in which you say it doesn't have to be. And in fact, I leave the book feeling very encouraged and optimistic because I know how serious an economist you are. How do we possibly get to this more positive future?
Well, first, thanks, and what a pleasure to see you today. Thanks to all of you for a chance to have a conversation on these important topics. I think the key word for me on this whole subject is crowded. There's something different about our time something which makes our challenge distinct from challenges of earlier generations. We're 6.7 billion people now on the planet. When the industrial age started just a couple centuries ago, we were about one-tenth that number. The world's really filled up, and it's also filled up in terms of productivity, that's good, and human impact on each other and on the planet. The amount of output or resources that we each use on average has also risen from the beginning of the industrial age till now by at least an order of magnitude, really more. And so if you take the rise of population and the rise of impact of each of us, the per capita rise, we're talking about a hundreds times more impact on the planet than ever before. Therefore, the problems we face have never been seen before. We have a global scale reach, a global scale intensity of interconnection, and a capacity on the positive side to create more value, more wealth, more well-being than was imaginable even a generation ago, certainly than could have ever been dreamt a few generations ago. And at the same time, of course, we have in our hands the ability not only through nuclear weapons to destroy everything, but through just neglect or naivete or a lack of scientific knowledge, a capacity to destroy the very foundations of our well-being if we simply go on doing what we're doing. That's how we've arrived at the current situation. And the book goes through two points, Ira, that I think are important. One is that even if we're just here doing what we're doing and we continue nothing more than year in, year out, 6.7 billion people, what is now estimated to be about $9,000 output per person on the planet average. That's about $45,000 per person in the U.S. and sometimes just hundreds in the poorest countries. If we just went on doing that, we are literally unsustainable in terms of the impact that we're having on the physical processes of the Earth. But, and here's the second point, we're not standing still. What we're doing is accelerating for a very good reason, which is that a lot of the poorest places in the world have caught the bug of economic development. They figured out how to adapt technologies to their needs very quickly. We have a boom that is unique in history in China and India underway. And so however much pressure we're putting on right now, wait a year, wait 10 years. China by itself has been doubling every 7 years for 1.3 billion people. So we're kind of driving fast towards some, I don't know what your favorite grim metaphor is, either a brick wall or a cliff. I won't mix them. And we got to head off. And we got an Oval Office that it doesn't even get it. They don't see ahead. And they're looking backwards, fighting wars of the past, and not looking ahead. And that's the premise of the book, that this is a special time. And of course, we can steer to safety. In fact, in some ways, it's so simple for a lot of these challenges, Ira, because I do think about us going towards a cliff, but I also think about the road turning gently away from the cliff if we just turn the steering wheel. But I'm not so keen on who's got the hands on the steering wheel right now. And so I'm worried that we're just going to catapult needlessly into disaster because we're too afraid to look, because we're not thinking scientifically, because we're too busy fighting each other, because we think that the transcendent issue of our age is Islamic extremism or some nonsense like that, which one of our presidential candidates says. And because if we view this as our major challenge, we will never get to the things that really count.
So you talked, Jeff, in the book about politicians and leaders who at other inflection points, tipping points in our recent past have been bold. Kennedy promising to land a man on the moon when the technology wasn't in place and he didn't live to see it, but within the decade it was done, the Manhattan Project and, you know, the Green Revolution in India. Why are we so tepid in our imagination? Why are leaders, and you've known so many of them personally, Bush 41 and 43 and Clinton and Kofi Annan and Ban Ki-moon and so many, Tony Blair, what is it about our politics these days that won't propel many leaders to boldly assert the kinds of solutions and approaches that you say are so urgently needed?
I think partly it is how unusual these challenges are and how it forces us to think in a different kind of way. Think about the climate change issue, of course. I'm sure everyone here has been thinking hard about this for a number of years, but in the scheme of things, this is a brand new issue for the world. It's true, and actually quite a remarkable thing, that an absolutely brilliant Swedish chemist in 1896 figured out the basics of this, and he was caught in an unhappy relationship, and to while away about 18 months, he, with hand calculations, made the most astoundingly brilliant calculations of what rising carbon dioxide would actually do for the planet, and he got it right. No computer, no calculator, Arrhenius, and he got a Nobel Prize, not for this, but for his genius more generally. But for the rest of us mortals, this is a new thing. And there have been other new things like this, one that I think is we can perhaps come back to, but for me it's a very, very both frightening, galvanizing, and in some ways also inspiring story, and that is the ozone depletion. That came at us like that. Absolutely an accidental scientific discovery, by the way, because the scientists that found it weren't really tracking down some mystery. They happened to come on it in the 1970s, and NASA happened to have put up a satellite that could actually measure stratospheric ozone and take a picture of that hole over Antarctica, and the world happened to get its act together to save itself. But these things are coming fast because how could humankind destroy the ozone level? The whole world's. It's only because of this large-scale industrial worldwide economy that we have. So these things weren't even possible before. So I want to give us some slack. This is not a Jeremiad of saying, how can we go on in this completely irresponsible way? I really am not trying to be an Old Testament prophet in this. I'm rather saying, look, we got serious problems. Do not read the Wall Street Journal editorial page for your science. That's my advice.
Or the president's science advisor.
Certainly even less the White House, because they only read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. But I'm trying to say this is real, and it's new. It is new. And so it's not completely imponderable why we're not quite getting it right. But several things have also happened in the last 25 years that have jolted what was, at least sporadically, at least true U.S. leadership on many issues. And we've become highly militarized, even more than we really know, because our budget other than Social Security, Medicare, and a couple of other items, is basically military beginning to end. And this is something that is really not felt by us properly, even though Eisenhower warned about it. And the rest of the world is not exactly providing wonderful leadership also. And then 9/11 was, of course, a tragedy, yes, and a disaster, yes, but it also misdirected us for another 7 years into a completely misguided kind of approach to global problems. And I can understand how we've gotten here. We just got to get off this path. That's basically it. It's nobody's doing, well, I won't say nobody. I was going to say that nobody's doing absolutely terrible. I'm not going to say that. What I am going to say is that it's not hugely shocking that we haven't gotten our act together, but it's wrong to think we can't get our act together. And what I'm really trying to do, and basically a kind of approach that has grown on me in the last 20 years, especially in the last 15 years, and not by design, just a little bit by accident, I found myself spending more and more time as an economist listening to specialists in other fields. And it became the core part of my daily activities, in fact, listening to a malariologist or listening to an AIDS specialist or listening to a climate scientist. And what I've concluded is that there really is a tremendous amount of practical knowledge around, and most expertise is deeply disempowered. And we live in a very noisy age where it's very hard to filter information also, and where, again, we've happened to have an administration that is uniquely incompetent in these matters, and deeply worrisome so, because people decided they want to elect a guy that they'd like to have a beer with rather than a guy that knows something about how to keep us safe. And that's a big mistake for us. We should be completely uninterested in that. I'd much rather have a president that actually reads at least the front half of Science magazine once a week, so that we have a chance to understand the real challenges that we're facing. So the more I've had the chance to listen and now head an institute completely dedicated to an interdisciplinary understanding of these issues, the more you hear great ideas every day. Not every one of them is going to pan out. But the basic thing I can do as an economist is keep telling them, that's not so expensive. That's not so expensive. Because the one thing a macroeconomist knows is orders of magnitude. And when you have a $15 trillion economy, which we have, and when the Wall Street crowd gets $35 billion for their Christmas bonus, when the malariologists tell me that they need a few hundred million dollars and how could we ever get that, I can tell them that's not so much. And so a lot of the book is really trying to encapsulate practicalities and to say it's not utopian. And I hope it comes through. This is not arguing for it, actually tries to tamp it down. It's not arguing for a grand new philosophy of life and grand new meaning of life. It's not arguing for a deep new morality. It's actually saying, look, for a tiny bit of money, we can stay away from that cliff. Why don't we all agree to it? And you agree to it for your values. I'll agree to it for my values. But none of us, whether it's from our religion or our secular views or our political views or our geopolitical views, none of us likes the cliff. So here's a low-cost way to avoid the cliff.
It's a very powerful argument. I was a little surprised, Jeff, in reading the book that you're as pro-growth as you are, because you start at the outset by describing in E.O. Wilson's very graphic terms the extinction of species accelerating at 1,000 times the pace if we hadn't been destroying the environment. But you actually paint a portrait, which I, as a business school dean, was delighted to learn about, where in the year 2050, we as Americans can continue to enjoy a privileged quality of life, and where the rest of the world, they don't catch up to us, but they can enjoy what we have today.
Yes.
I stopped at that and said, why wouldn't we invest in that scenario where as Jeff earlier recounted, we have about a $40,000 income in the United States for families, and Jeff says it can be $90,000 in 2050, and the rest of the world can be about $20,000 to $40,000.
Right.
And you describe and make it accessible as an economist a convergence of economies in places like Vietnam and Sri Lanka, where they can join the mainstream. How is this possible without destroying the environment?
So first, it's basically I have a view which I think is demonstrated by deep observed processes that the rest of the world can catch up in part with us, and that I take that as a good thing. And I describe very briefly the period since the Industrial Revolution in the following way. First, up until around 1800, the whole world was poor all the time. This is very important to understand.
Yeah, in fact, I remember that graphically because I didn't know this. You said that in 1800, 85% of the world lived in abject poverty.
Yeah, basically everybody was a subsistence farmer besides, a king and a queen who were one step above subsistence farming. They might still have low life expectancy, not have the most basic things, but essentially the world was 90% rural. Maybe 10% urban. That's because farming was so unproductive in general that it took 90% of the population to feed the 100%. That's the right way to think about it. When farming becomes hugely productive, then 1%, like we have, can feed the other 99%. So that's a measure of the scientific productivity of modern farming, in essence. But up until 1800, there wasn't scientific farming, and there wasn't energy was basically what humans could carry or what animals could carry, and a little bit of wind power and a little bit of water power, and that was it. And then came the steam engine, and the modern world was built on fossil fuels. And for a long time, basically for the first 150 years, we lived in a period that economists call divergence, economic divergence. And that means that essentially the rich got richer, and the poor didn't really catch up, so the gaps widened. And the rich were Northern Europe, or Western Europe and the United States, and to the extent that there were people there, Australia, New Zealand, because not very big population, but basically was the North Atlantic world. And the Industrial Revolution, the science-based technology started there. Having coal was the real ticket to success when you combined it with the steam engine and all the inventions, and that just gave a liftoff to industrialization in a small corner of the world. And the only one that joined that club outside of the North Atlantic in the 19th century was Japan. And that's a most marvelous story of history, absolutely, for an economist. The fascinating story, because Japan invented catching up growth, in fact. And every other country that's ever caught up has emulated Japan in certain important ways. That lasted for 150 years, and it had two elements that I think are important to understand. One was that the tricks of science-based industrialization were still heavily concentrated in a small part of the world. Literate scientific communities, ability to master this technology, and that gave such a liftoff that essentially Europe went up and beat the heck out of most of the rest of the world in what was the remainder of the colonial era. Once they discovered how to stay alive from malaria, Africa was taken over in basically 10 years, once quinine was mass-produced in the 1860s. So because of the politics and the economics, you had this North Atlantic dominance of the world, first the British Empire, then after World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, the American dominance. And you had the rest of the world in colonial state or semi-colonial dependence, with Japan as being a notable exception. After 1950, I believe things changed fundamentally in a very deep way, although only gradually could one see it, and I call that the age of convergence. Why convergence? Because after 40 years of bloodletting in of the most unimaginable kind in Europe. Europe was exhausted. Empire came to an end. Independence came. That was a prerequisite for catching up in the rest of the world. Not everyone was smart enough to figure out how to do it, but it was a prerequisite at least. Literacy spread. More and better technologies allowed for diffusion of this well-being. And basically, catching up became the norm rather than the exception. It was no longer just Japan. Now, after 1978, it was China. From the 1980s onward, it was India. Just those two are almost 40% of the world's population. Southeast Asia, adding in hundreds of millions more. Brazil, and so on. So I believe that most of the world is actually in this catching up phase. Catching up's easier than leading, by the way. The technologies are out there, so you just adopt them. Whereas leading is hard. Those are lots of blind alleys. So leaders, and the United States has been the technological leader for 200 years, we've been growing at about 1.7% per year per capita. That means our economy doubles every 40 years. When you start impoverished now, but you're socially organized, you have the right politics, you're part of the world, you're in peace, you're not colonized, and you have the rest of what it takes. You have a good port and other things. Then you can catch up. And that growth in China has been 10% per capita. That's a doubling every 7 years. And so that's why you get the narrowing, not because the top falls down, but because the bottom catches up. So that's a very long-winded answer to the first half of a real full-part question, which is, why do I believe you can have economic growth and environmental sustainability? Well, the first part is, why do I believe you can have economic growth? Because I believe in technological catching up at the core, and I believe that our scientific capacity can continue if we choose to have it so, and I'll say a few words about that. Now, how can you combine this with the environment?
Which was because the real remind us that China's building two 500 megawatt coal-fired energy plants a week and doubling. Every year they're producing as much electricity from coal as England has in its entirety.
Yeah, now the scale of transformation is simply unimaginable. So the question then is the following. Okay, I've given an answer as far as mainstream economics gives, actually, because mainstream economics, weirdly enough, hardly touches the physical world. It's really true. We learn in our models the first year of graduate school a model where the only two factors of production, so-called, are labor, that's us, and capital, which we make by the output produced by labor and capital. There's no nature in it. And so for mainstream economics, nature's really not a problem. It, you know, there's a little bit to learn in this. But the truth is, of course, there's nature there, and we use resources, and we live in a physical world, and we are physical beings, and we depend on water, food supply, energy resources, and so forth. So then the real question is that scenario of catching up at all feasible, or will it get choked off by the fact that it presumes implicitly that there's going to be the oil and the coal available, that there's the water available, and so on? That's a deep question. That's why I wrote the book, and that's what we're really grappling with. And my answer in a nutshell is the following. If we simply replicate, so if it's nothing more than just China replicating our model, as it were, because that's what catching up is to an important extent. If it's just replication, it can't work, actually. And so that scenario does break down. And a good exemplar of what replication means is the Tata Nano, which you've all heard about. This new, wondrously engineered $2,500 car, which demonstrates it's Tata's prowess, but the Tata Motors has now put a perfectly fine car on the road for $2,500. And I really always say I do have this image that in 10 years when you open a bank account, you're going to get a car alongside it, if there are any banks left, by the way. But because we're so good at this kind of manufacturing engineering right now. That's the catching up part. But is there the oil for that? Where is it going to come from? We're already at $110 a barrel oil. So what the book really says is the following. If we simply multiply, no, it won't work. But if we think ahead, that's how you steer along the road. The technologies are such, and the fundamental resources, energy, water, land, are such, we can actually accommodate that kind of growth, but only if we consciously now mobilize to develop sustainable technologies. For example, you know, a favorite of California, rightly so, is solar power. The amount of insulation, incoming solar radiation, is 10,000 times our energy use. So we got a lot of sunshine for at least another billion years, and we're in pretty good shape with that. It costs about four times our conventional energy right now. But if you talk to any good engineer in solar, they'll give you a shelf load of great ideas being explored right now, none of them being explored with the intensity and the amount of resources needed, but a whole host of ideas that are not science fiction, but need development. So you think about this massive amount of resource that we have, and wonderful study in, published in Scientific American last December, illustrating a model of how the Mojave Desert by itself could provide about 60% of U.S. electricity needs. Because that's how intense the solar radiation is. And North Africa could provide all of the electricity that Europe needs easily, not at today's costs, so not commercially today, but in terms of resource base, yes. Or you look in any of the other areas discussed in the book, one of the obvious concerns, again, a good California concern, but a concern for all of us, is how we're destroying the oceans right now by gutting them of fish, also killing the corals about 10 times over by every different kind of intervention. But I'm a huge fan of the potential of aquaculture, for example, to find our way through what is now a true ocean, global ocean scale crisis. And one of the interesting things that's happened is that over the last 50 years, there was an explosion of demand for fish. It's a great part of our diet. It's one of the absolute healthiest things human beings can eat. And we went from some few tens of millions of tons of ocean catch per year up to 100 million tons. When we reached 100 million tons, we were destroying almost every fishery in the world, as we're continuing to do. It plateaued at about 100 million tons, not out of any self-control, but out of the destruction that we were causing, for instance, to the New England and the Newfoundland fisheries. At that point, not simultaneous, actually, it is simultaneous with this, aquaculture, fish farming, was also taking off massively. It's reached now 50 million tons per year from 3 or 4 million tons per year. China is by far the biggest fish farming country in the world, probably responsible for 75 or 80% of the global fish farming. Now, that's great news as far as I'm concerned, except for one big problem, which is that the fish farming still is not all that it would need to be truly environmentally sustainable. And there are a number of reasons for that. But without going into those, it's an example, like solar power, of a sustainable technology that with proper investment, proper foresight, closes this gap or squares the circle of combining growth and environmental sustainability. And my view is, while it's not proved, in each of the major areas, land use, water use, oceans, climate change, and so forth, we have in sight not abstract hopes for the future, but actually pretty concrete things that are not commercial right now, but are somewhat close to being commercial, or are commercial but aren't working quite right, but could be made to work right, which can allow us to combine these two absolutely legitimate aspirations, in my view. What I'm trying to argue against is the very divided camp that we have. You read the Wall Street Journal, and I think there was another editorial yesterday or today, we must never sacrifice growth for these stupid objectives of avoiding a 1 or 2 degree centigrade increase in the planet, because they have not a clue as to what that really means biologically. So, you know, what difference if we all have 105 degrees temperature? That's just a few degrees more than normal. That can't bother us. Would just kill us all. So they don't get that. And then the other side are the environmental groups that say the most important thing is the rich have to cut decisively their living standards. And I also, God, I hope that's not true. A, because kind of like our living standards, but B, because that would really be a brutal battle. Yeah. And I don't want a brutal battle if we can avoid a brutal battle. I'd rather say, no, that's not quite right. Here are ways that we can find our way through without having to do that.
It's all very hopeful, Jeff, but given that the United Nations is the principal intermediary for global cooperation, and it's viewed as ineffective and feckless and sometimes corrupt, why are you encouraged that we can get our act together and collaborate on a global basis? We haven't even signed the Kyoto Protocol. These issues aren't the focus of our presidential campaign. But even if they were, and if our newest leaders believed in your prescription, why are you, and you've seen the inside of the beast, you know Ban Ki-moon and you know Kofi Annan and what courageous guys they are, but the institution itself seems so ineffective. Why are you hopeful that that's a mechanism that we can latch onto? Because one of the basic insights in the book that I come away with is you say it's all there. We have the smarts. We might even have the values. It's a misalignment. We're thinking in parochial, nationalistic terms when we really have to come together as a common wealth. But what's the mechanism if not the United Nations?
I think we can have the institutions we want. There's no iron law that says the United Nations has to be tied up in knots. It's tied up in knots because the United States has wanted it to be that way, frankly, for recent years, and so have other leading powers. You know, we're not the only ones in this, but you know we had an administration whose absolutely dominant core beliefs early on was that the United Nations is nothing but handcuffs of the sole superpower. So why should we ever do anything with the UN? Because anything we could do with the UN, we could do for ourselves better because we can do anything we want. That was the philosophy. And we're so powerful, it would be just stupid for Gulliver to, you know, tie himself up with the Lilliputians. And that was really the philosophy. Now I think it was nuts to begin with to presume this, but now I think it's exposed also as being exactly what it was. So there are two levels of question. You know, my book was reviewed by The Economist last week, and it was okay. They didn't say anything was wrong. They said the real problem with the book is the real basic problem with the book is that it's too worthy. That was the word they used.
Well, they also talked about Sachs appeal.
Yeah, right. So they said the book
was envious.
They said the book is too worthy. The real problem is Jeff Sachs believes that the world is as reasonable as he is. And if the world were as reasonable as he is, we wouldn't have these problems. So the attack was on my reasonability. Which I confess to. I try to be reasonable. That's what we were.
Actually, just a little bit of truth in advertising here. Jeff has also been described as quite unreasonable.
Right.
Bono calls him a pest.
Right.
And Mark Malik Brown says he's a pain in the ass.
Right.
And,
absolutely.
You know, so.
No, I try, you know, to do my best when I get the moment. But basically, I believe in the end, I don't know if you'd agree, but I believe that what really stops us in the end is the lack of clarity of what to do. That's a very rationalistic approach. And people obviously disagree with that because we're capable of every kind of inanity and foolishness and going off. But I wrote this out of the belief that, and I live my life and pursue my career out of the belief that if we have clarity about low-cost solutions to high-cost problems, we could actually find our ways to them. I'll give an example. Give an example?
Yeah.
I've been campaigning for 10 years for anti-malaria bed nets. Okay. This is one of those technologies that I learned about from first seeing children die with malaria, something that I could never have imagined in a million years I'd actually see. Never thought I'd see a child in death throes. And when I began working in Africa, it became a normal part of my life, which was weird to begin with because you're kind of growing up to believe that shouldn't be a normal part of anybody's life. But then I learned from malariologists about anti-malaria bed nets about a decade ago. And I discussed with them how low cost they are and how effective they are. And I took up this cause because, again, as a macroeconomist, I knew that the cost of this stuff was vanishingly small. It was rounding error in anybody's budget accounts. So I headed a commission for WHO and headed a project for Kofi Annan and had a team for Ban Ki-moon and have been working on this for a long time.
What does a bed net cost?
So a bed net is $5, and you hook it up on the top of a bed, and it's treated with insecticide, and it lasts 5 years. And it has three effects. One is mosquitoes can't stand the smell, so it's called excitorepellency, and they stay out of the hut. And second, if they land on it, it kills them before what's called the sporogony cycle, which is a 14-day period before they become infective to bite someone with malaria. And third, it is physically protective. It's a barrier, although not perfect because you sleep with your bum up against it and the mosquito can bore through it. So as a physical barrier, it has a bit of an effect, and as an excitorepellency, it adds on and so on. But it's very effective. It stops a half to two-thirds of the transmission. And the rest need to be treated with medicine, but you can break transmission this way. Okay, I understood this a while ago, and for me, 10 years ago, it was so incredibly painfully obvious. We had to get bed nets out to people. And when you work in villages, you also learn immediately, people can't afford the bed nets because they have no money. They don't have $5. They don't have a bank account. They got zero. And when you hear about a dollar a day poverty, that doesn't mean a dollar or a kwacha. It means the maze that they've grown, imputed by a statistician as having the value of a dollar a day. It's subsistence. So you can't sell stuff to people that have no money. Sachs's theorem number one.
He was a tenured economist at Harvard
absolutely.
At the age of 28.
You need PhDs for this stuff. Okay, so 10 years ago, you know, after having the privilege of working with leading malariologists, I came to understand this, and I headed a lot of international efforts. It's incredibly painful how hard it is to actually raise the funds for this. Now, how much do we need? Let me give you a little bit more arithmetic. It's 300 million sleeping sites in Africa in the transmission regions. And sleeping sites matter because these are called endophagic anophelines, meaning that they bite inside. It's an anopheline genus of mosquito, and they bite inside, endophagic, indoor biting. And so they bite at night, and you protect at night, and that's why it works. Even though people go out during the day, they don't bite in the day. Okay, 300 million sites, $5 a bed net, $1.5 billion, another PhD help, although you could do it on a spreadsheet now. And they last 5 years, these bed nets now. They're brilliantly engineered so that the insecticide does not rub off when you wash it. And it's actually so clever in the one kind that one of the kinds, Sumitomo Chemicals, they put the insecticide into the resin, and then when the thing is woven by machine, it's right in the resin, so it constantly secretes this stuff over a five-year period with each washing. Great engineering of a lifesaver. Okay, for years, nothing. Why? Because you geniuses in USAID thought we ought to sell these bed nets, and the market is really important, and people don't value things unless they're people don't value things given for free unless they happen to be billionaires. Poor people only value things that they have to buy with money they don't have. And all these Washington wisdom, bits of wisdom. So we didn't get the bed nets out, and it's been a 10-year campaign. So why am I optimistic? Because slowly, slowly, truth actually can prevail. So in 2000, I worked with Kofi Annan. We got a global fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria going. That started free distribution of bed nets, too small a scale because we didn't fund that properly, but it started. Then UNICEF and the International Red Cross combined giving out bed nets with their measles initiative. That proved some more successes. Then in 2005, I worked with the Bush administration at arm's length, by phone mainly, to encourage them to have a malaria initiative. And the champion of that is a wonderful person who was a colleague of ours also at the Kennedy School, Bob Zelick, who really is a terrific person and was Deputy Secretary of State and is now head of the World Bank. And he did a wonderful job and got the president's malaria initiative going, PMI. But here's Washington. You tell the numbers, and I said we need, when you add it all up, bed nets, medicines, and all the rest, we need about $3 billion a year for comprehensive malaria control, of which the United States should put in $1 billion. But by the end, they announced not $1 billion a year, but $1.2 billion over 5 years. Because OMB, first, the people at OMB do not have children living in malaria zones. Second, they know nothing, unfortunately. Third, USAID is gutted. And fourth, Washington is dysfunctional in this way. They just don't do arithmetic. And so it came out one-fifth of what it ought to be, although something got started. Okay, so still, why am I optimistic? Because minutes before walking over here from the hotel nearby, turned on the TV, CNN. There are the clips of American Idol Gives Back. There's 5 minutes about bed nets in the center of American pop culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is now, next week, or actually April 25th, you don't know it, but it's World Malaria Day, and there'll be an announcement of a comprehensive scale-up. Something dramatic is happening. Truth finally is getting out, because how many years can you leave 1 million children to die for the lack of this funding? And let me give you the final denominator, because again, that's what a macroeconomist does. I can divide and multiply, basically, and with dollar signs. We're spending right now $700 billion a year on the military. I refuse to call it the defense budget because that's a misnomer. It's the offense budget and the defense budget. $700 billion a year. And that's about $1.9 billion a day right now. So I want you to all realize that for less than one day's Pentagon spending, we could protect every sleeping site in Africa for 5 years against malaria. For less than one day's Pentagon spending. So one of my proposals is that the Pentagon take next Thursday off. And I believe in the end that these approaches do the costing, show the technology, have specifics, can find their way through the morass and the confusion that we live in. And that's why I'm optimistic, because there really are a lot of wonderful ideas and wonderful technologies out there. And if we can keep our head about it and not go over the cliff beforehand, we can find our way to mobilize them.
Thanks, Jeff. It's now your turn. So I think Justin's going to move the mic around. And while he does, let me just observe before we take the first question. And I'd ask that you pose a question rather than making a statement. I want to make a little statement, which is that there are probably 10,000 tenured economists in America or more. And I don't think there's another Jeff Sachs who spends his time. Oh, maybe it's Muhammad Yunus. Actually, Muhammad Yunus, who some of you saw in the same forum not long ago.
What a wonderful guy.
He's also an economist who's devoted his life to combating poverty amongst women in rural Bangladesh through Grameen Bank. But there's not another economist of Jeff's stature, his intellectual pedigree, his standing, who spent 10 years trying to bring malarial nets to Africa. And I think we all owe him an enormous debt of gratitude for being so courageous. Okay, we have many hands and little time, so let's go. And I'll try not to get in your way, except to make sure that, yes, the questions are short, as are Jeff's answers, so we can get through everyone.
Short question. What is your opinion of the effect of using food to make fuel in the developing world?
Terrible idea. Period. We're putting one-third of our maize this year into the gas tank, and it's leading to a cascading explosion of food prices. It's ridiculous. It makes no sense on a carbon basis. I can't give short answers, probably.
No, but...
But it makes no sense on a carbon basis. It makes no sense on its implications for everything else. And at best, biofuels on non-edible sources, switchgrass and wood chips and cellulosic and so on, but not with food.
Rice is up 30% in China, the price of rice.
Yeah, and rice here is more than doubled. It's up to, wheat is at more than $900 a ton, and it was about $375 a ton beginning of 2006.
It's this woman right here. Thank you, please.
Thank you so much. If I don't forget what I was going to ask, Mr. Sachs, when we have a new administration, and you are their first or our first director of sustained development or whatever in their cabinet, what would be your first recommendations?
Can I give you, not that that's going to be my job, but I already wrote the memo. I'll give you my 10 steps for January 21 very quickly. No joke. This is... I don't know who's going to do it, but this is what the president should do. One, end the Iraq war immediately. We could elaborate on any of those, but that's going to save $200 billion a year. End the Bush tax cuts. That's another $250 billion a year. Third, go from $3 billion to $30 billion in our investments, public investments in sustainable energy. We need a National Institutes of Sustainable Technologies like we have a National Institutes of Health. Okay? And the National Institutes of Health is funded at $30 billion a year, and it's a comparable challenge and a comparable set of returns and a comparable need. Fourth, first day, actually, I'm letting them have their gala ball, so I'm setting it for the 21st, not the 20th of January. First working day, send a climate envoy to China, India, European Union, Russia, and other countries to tell them we're back in the negotiating business, and we're going to try to reach an agreement on climate change in Copenhagen, Conference of the Parties of the Framework Convention, December 2009. Five on my list, stop the subsidies for ethanol. Sixth, sign the Convention on Biological Diversity and the UN Convention on Law of the Sea, and begin once again to abide by global treaties. Let's include the Geneva Conventions in that. Seventh, invite the leaders of Senegal, Burkina Faso, Mali, Chad, Niger, Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And I would include some California communities, Phoenix, Arizona, Australia. They're all dryland communities.
Desert cities. Yeah.
Desert cities. I would invite all of them to a White House drylands initiative on managing the global water supply. And I would, because we are not fighting Islamic fundamentalism, we're fighting hunger, we're fighting water stress, we're fighting environmental degradation, and these were on the same side of the issues as people we think are on the other side of the barricades. And we should let them know that it's Tehran and Phoenix and Sydney that all have a water problem. And this, I think, so that's number seven. Number eight, restart immediately our funding of the UN Population Fund, which the Bush administration cut to zero. Nine, make the Millennium Development Goals the centerpiece for our international development strategy. We will have 7 years left, and the United States can play a very important role. And 10th, establish a Department for International Sustainable Development so that we have some place in the government that knows what it's doing.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so let's move it around here. This gentleman, please.
Given how hard it's taken for a no-brainer like mosquito nets to get implemented, how do you stay optimistic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
First, we do have in our world parallel processing. So even while the bed net fight's going on, Al Gore has been brilliantly leading the fight on public awareness for climate change, for example. And there's been progress on other areas. There's actually a not bad level of technical understanding at a global level on many issues. Of course, I'm, again, excluding the White House in this. But we've actually made a lot of progress on a lot of technical level issues, not at the political level, not at the implementation level. But there are things that really can move quickly. Let me give another technology that I regard as incredibly promising, and that's plug-in hybrids, because that is a technology that within a few years could give us an automobile, high-performance, reliable, available technologies that can do 100 miles per gallon or more. And if it's plugged into a clean power grid, then you've made a marvelous large-scale contribution. And Chevrolet is going to come out with a plug-in hybrid 2010. So there are lots of things that could be done pretty quickly with leadership. It's hard to emphasize, I mean, you know it, but it's a little hard to imagine how absent we've been from this kind of leadership for quite a long time. And what frankly is very disappointing is that the Clinton years were not active leadership in this either. The Clinton years were, in fact, what happened was, it was a little bit, they said exactly, we're not going to do that, then they did it. And that was at the end of the Cold War. It was really like the return to normalcy. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, we'll cut the military budget, and good, and we'll go to make money. It's the economy, stupid. And it wasn't all these other things. They were a little bit aware of them, but, you know, didn't really do very much about them, partly hamstrung by Congress, I suppose, but partly we wanted at the end of the Cold War to breathe a little, live a little, not really invest in reshaping the world. These things were not seen very clearly, frankly. So we've been going a long time without much clarity, but it's when it comes, it will seem obvious. And so it's not going to be impossible to see large changes in ideas taking hold, surprisingly large changes in ideas. And it won't be weird for the rest of the world because they're basically wondering, where the hell is the United States in all of this? That's the dominant feeling around the world, is what happened? You know, we're just not part of the same discussion that they are. And if we come back into this, we don't even have to lead. We just have to want to participate actively. I'm not calling for unique U.S. leadership to save the world. I'm really not. I'm calling for us to be a normal participating country.
Just to show
that,
up.
That has a big stake in it, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, we're almost getting the hook, Jeff. So we're going to try to take as many questions as we can,
right.
But we also, I
yes
think,
yes and no,
recording.
Multiple choice questions.
Okay, so let's zip along, please.
Where is the invisible hand in all of this, and why do we fail to put these, or actually, why do we put failed leaders into this place?
Yeah. So first, the invisible hand is the markets are very powerful, scalable social institutions, but they have to be directed in the right way. If it's absolutely free to put carbon dioxide in the air, markets will not solve the climate change issue. And so we know that there are, we call the market failures, the signals are wrong just about everywhere on these particular issues. So we got to fix the markets with market correctives, but then realize one more thing, and this will be a new theme, I believe, of economics in the coming years in a much bigger way. Knowledge and innovation is a very complex activity that involves market forces operating with patent incentives and non-market forces like NIH or the universities or the Gates Foundation. And so it's a subtle mix of public and private institutions working together to address technological problems that has to be at a base of this, because at least my way of thinking about this, at the core of what I'm talking about is what is called RDD&D. We sometimes call it R&D, research and development, but the right thing we need is research, development, demonstration, and diffusion of technologies. And that requires a chain of institutions, public, private, nonprofit, civil society foundations, operating towards common goals, each adding a different piece of the puzzle. The invisible hand can't do it by itself. It's a piece of the answer.
Two last questions. This gentleman and then the woman in the first row in the back.
Thank you. Professor Sachs, could you comment on the criticism of the Millennium Development Goals, that they're too idealistic, that they can't be feasible in the next 7 years, that people need to start at a lower common denominator than these things that you've helped create?
Well, first, I didn't help create them. These were set by the world's governments in the year 2000. Kofi Annan, if there's a creator, is the creator of them because he put them before the world. But the world's governments adopted them. I came to help Kofi get them implemented to try to figure out practical paths for implementation. If I thought they were impossible, I would have said so a long time ago. When I say that they're feasible, even today, it's not just hot air, it's actually analysis. I'll give you an example. Measles deaths have come down by 91% in Africa in the last 7 years. 91%. Very practical technology in immunization, a delivery mechanism, financing. And the analysis that I would suggest is we know this is not to end climate change in 7 years. This is about child mortality, maternal mortality, AIDS, malaria, TB, and so on. All of those have already proved technologies. So the issue isn't even R&D. The issue is basically the last D. It's diffusion of technologies. It's within cost. It's within budget. It's things like bed nets, anti-malaria medicines, antiretroviral medicines, community health workers, seed and fertilizer. Nothing has to be done that isn't already known and proved how to do it. And that's the sense in which this is not some fantasy. It's a sense of mobilization of effort rather than a need for discovery of the unknown. That's coming later. But for the Millennium Development Goals dated to 2015, that is application scale-up of known and proven technologies.
Yes.
Thank you for your talk today. What can we do starting today to make or to be a positive change and to help the environment or the world?
Great, thanks. First, let's make sure that on January 20, we have someone that's going to lead this country properly. That's really important. And so for the next few months, making clear to the political leaders that we expect change, that it can be accomplished, that we expect the United States to be a major participant peacefully, that we got to get out of Iraq. Those are all powerful parts of any solution to this, and I think they're really critical. If Mr. McCain doesn't change his viewpoint when he says that the transcendent issue of our time is Islamic extremism, that represents to me the biggest danger that this country continues right towards the cliff. So, you know, we need a point of view that understands what the real issues are, and that is crucial. And that means in every way public understanding in the schools, in the political debates, making this safe for the politicians, demanding it of the politicians, and all the rest. In terms of our own actions, I think everybody needs to do something, but what one needs to do depends on who you are, where you work, what you do. Everybody, at least, give a $10 bed net if you do nothing else. And that's $5 plus delivery.
So where can you make that contribution?
And so you go to malarianomore.org, and you get a bed net right to a village. Okay, just do that, and you'll have helped to save a life, and that's a wonderful contribution. Mm-hmm. But every community can mobilize, can do added resources, can get this into the schools. We're helping schools to make contact directly with schools in Africa and other parts of the world so that our kids understand the world that they're growing up in, and not taking it from us, but in direct contact. So school-to-school connections. Millennium Promise, an organization that I co-founded, which is an NGO devoted to the Millennium Development Goals, champions a program called the Millennium Villages, which allow people to contribute. Now it's about 500,000 people covered, and we expect it'll be about 1 million people shortly in the poorest parts of Africa to help them get the agriculture, health, education, infrastructure investments so that they can lift themselves out of extreme poverty. Many churches are taking this on. Businesses are doing things. I say to every business when they say, what can we do? The main thing I want from businesses, think about your technology. What can your technology add? Because that's where your value is. It's not so much your money. You know, you're not a charity, but you are a repository of know-how, of management capacity, of insight. So how can you add to this global challenge? And I'm sachs@columbia.edu. That's the email address. And I give free consultations on how one can contribute to sustainable development.
That's great. Unfortunately, I've got to wrap up the evening. We're all going to have an opportunity to meet Jeff personally and to have him sign a book. Let me just quote, not from the recent Economist review, but from a review that I did of Jeff's book. Ultimately, Sachs concludes, the world is in our hands, largely to make or to break. If we tap advanced technologies, confront brutal realities, think creatively, and act morally, our 21st century can be a period of shared prosperity, a safer and more democratic world with lessened hatreds and resentments, and a newfound respect for sustained growth for posterity. Sachs's roadmap, while ambitious, is plausible. His tactics, while requiring choices, are feasible. And his agenda, while disruptive, is driven by optimism and hope and based on historical precedent. His voice, his words, his ideas, his prescriptions are worth listening to and acting upon in our own self-interest and before it's too late. Please join me in thanking Professor Jeff Sachs.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.